But I think the principles of justice that we've been discussing, utility, freedom, the Kantian idea, and virtue and the good life, that these theories of justice do inform questions of justice that arise among nations. And to start with these extreme situations is a way of isolating the principles so that we can apply them later when we come to these bigger questions having to do with nations and communities and people and the global community of the community of humankind.
First of all, thank you, Professor Sandel, for giving us such an inspiring lecture. I have a question: that what do we do when what is just conflicts with what is reasonable? For example, in the lifeboat situation, this might be based on my understandings of what is just and reasonable, but in that situation, I think it would be unjust to kill the orphan because there wasn't a process of agreement and he did not choose to be involved in it. But however, it seemed reasonable because it would save the other three lives. So my question is, what should we do when what is just conflicts with what is reasonable, or what is the better way for the common good of the society?
Right, very good. And very often we do have a conflict between what seems the just thing to do and what may actually contribute to the overall happiness. I think we have to ask when we have those conflicts, and very often the conflict is between justice and the overall happiness defined as prosperity or economic growth. Part of looking at real life, I think the way we often confront what seems to be a conflict between justice and welfare or the general happiness is when we have a conflict between justice and economic growth or prosperity. That's the classic conflict that we in modern societies face. And there's a temptation to think that the highest end of social life is to promote prosperity and welfare and GDP. There is that great temptation, and that's one of the great appeals of markets in the modern world. And that's true in both of our societies. I think that one thing that the United States and China have in common, and it's only recently come to be the case, is a faith in markets as the primary instrument of the common good. And I think we need to question that assumption, which too often goes unquestioned. And one way to question it is to ask, why exactly satisfying preferences of consumers matters? Now it matters because it increases pleasure. And that's good. We like pleasure. Jeremy Bentham pointed this out. We like pleasure and we dislike pain. And Jeremy Bentham said, we should make that fundamental psychological fact the basis of morality and justice. I think he was wrong about that. It's true we like pleasure and affluence and prosperity. Those are good things. But satisfying consumer preferences is not the only thing in life. And it may not be the most important thing, morally speaking, to satisfy consumer preferences. Now, if you believe that all human beings are pleasure machines, which is really what Bentham suggested. He suggested that to be a human being was really to be a bundle pleasures. That was the utilitarian idea. And if you believe that, then satisfying consumer preferences is the highest end of a society. And there is no independent question of justice. But I think there is reason to question the utilitarian idea that human beings are simply or fundamentally pleasure machines. You know, the utilitarians thought there could be if only we could find a machine to measure how much pleasure we really feel. A meter that somehow we could attach to people's brains. Maybe today we could use, some say we can use MRI, brain imaging, to find out what really gives people pleasure and what gives them pain. But I think that is a partial view of what it is to be a human being. And I think it's a view that doesn't really allow for human freedom. Because human freedom means more than just seeking after our desires. For a reason that Kant, I think, was right about. Kant said, if all freedom means is the ability to pursue what we want, our desires, without obstacle, where is the freedom in that? If the desires themselves were not of our own doing, that you like chocolate ice cream and that I like vanilla ice cream, those are just facts about us. And I suppose you could say that you're free if you can get chocolate ice cream and I'm free if I can get vanilla ice cream. But that is a small conception of freedom, an inadequate conception of freedom, because we haven't chosen those desires. Or that I want a fancy car to drive. I may have that desire, but have I chosen that desire freely? That was Kant's point. And so, this is why I think the utilitarian idea is flawed, is impoverished. And so I think are many ideas that say that market freedom is the whole freedom. Market freedom is just a way of satisfying our consumer preferences. It's not a way of being an active, willing agent in the world, capable of deliberating about what matters. To be free really is to be capable of deliberating about the good life as an active, conscious, willing agent. It isn't just to be seeking after our desires. So that's why I say where there are conflicts between justice and what satisfies our preferences as consumers, justice should, morally speaking, be decisive. So in many ways, this argument about utilitarianism is an argument, and we started with these extreme cases, it's really an argument about how much weight we should give to consumer preferences in a market society. That's one way of seeing what's at stake in it.
Thank you. Thank you. My question is, let's go back to the cabin boy case. There is a great distinguishment between the vote and the lottery. The two so cards are due process. And because for the vote, it can't get rid of the assumption. The assumption is a utilitarian one. For example, in that case, if the four guy, including the cabin boy, try a vote, before the vote, in their mind, there is assumption. They think that the one who should be cured is the one who gets sick. In the situation, because of the assumption, there is no so-called justice. But it's different to the lottery. In the lottery, the result is not decided by the poor guy, it's decided by maybe it's God. So there is no, it's not the utilitarian one. So it's different between the approach and the nature. But forget that. I want to write a text. If the cowboy was not killed by the others, but died by himself immediately, and whether it is a justice to each the dead body of the cowboy. So it will help us to distinguish in the case the mistake is murder or to each the dead body of the cowboy. So what's your
opinion? Good question. There are two issues here. Were they wrong to kill the cabin boy? Question number one, and number two, were they wrong to eat the cabin boy? And you're right, you can separate these two questions. Suppose they just waited for the first person to die, didn't kill anybody, and the cabin boy died, would it then be all right to eat the cabin boy? And I guess that depends whether you're a vegetarian or not. But you know, it actually, here's a way of thinking about it that is less extreme, maybe less extreme. We have debates about organ sales. Should people need a kidney to survive? And in China in 2007, the sale of organs was outlawed, as I understand it. In the United States, it's also illegal to sell organs for transplant. But there's a great need for organs. Now, I don't think that there should be a market in organs for transplantation, even though there would be consent. And we could discuss that the next time I visit, maybe. But what about when a person dies? Should his or her organs be available after death for transplantation, or should it depend on the person having agreed, having given consent in advance? That, in a way, is parallel to the question about what to do with the cabin boy once he died. My son is a vegetarian, by the way. How many here are vegetarians?
I have a question. We have some stories, but there are always three sailors and only one orphans. But the actual situation, especially in China, there are more orphans than sailors. We always, the people sit here, always, we are the best students in China. We always take ourselves as the sailors. The question to us is always, whether we should harm the other people. But what if we are the orphans, and the most people of China, what should we do? At this case, if justice means the same thing to us, here's my question. Thank you.
Yes, very good. Thank you. I think you're right. There is a tendency when we're discussing these cases where there are some with power and there are some who are victims without power. When we think about the moral dilemmas of power and powerlessness, there is a tendency for us to think of ourselves not as the cabin boy lying at the bottom of the boat, but as the captain with the penknife trying to decide what to do. I think it's a very good point, which suggests that justice and injustice, questions of justice and injustice, may look very different to those who hold power or who imagine themselves making the choices, and to those who may be powerless and who are not in a position very often to make these choices. What conclusion can we draw from that? I think it's a very good observation. When we engage in moral and political philosophy, we're trying to figure out the principles that should govern our individual lives and also our collective lives. And we presuppose that we are in a position or might be in a position of power or authority to act on those principles, which may make it all the more important to try to use our imagination to put ourselves in the place, not of the powerful, but of the powerless. To think of social life and justice from the standpoint not of the captain, but of the cabin boy. Now, in some ways, John Rawls's veil of ignorance is one way of trying to achieve that idea. To forget for the moment where we stand in society, whether at the top or at the bottom or somewhere in between. To forget for a moment whether we are powerful or powerless, strong or weak, healthy or unhealthy, and to reason about justice as if we didn't know, at least for a moment, what place we would occupy in the social order, whether we would be rich or poor. And though I disagree with John Rawls's theory in some respects, I think that impulse is morally very powerful. And I also agree with one of Rawls's conclusions that we should think about equality and inequality from the standpoint not of the strongest, but from the standpoint of those the least advantaged members of society. Despite my disagreements with some of John Rawls's theory of justice, I do think that insight and really the points you've made are important.
I was wondering whether my question is too short for all the time, but things I really want to ask, so here it goes. Let's put justice into practice. What is the status of justice to the government? We know that you served for the George W. Bush administration some years ago, so what is the advice you gave to the administration when you were working in the President's Council towards the 2003 Iraq event? I don't know whether you gave the advice, but if you did, what is your advice and whether the government followed your advice? What is consider it for a while and then just put it aside. If you didn't, I want to know what is your advice. Thank you.
Okay. It's a sharp question and a good one. And it gives me an opportunity to explain. I did not work in the Bush administration. And I disagreed with the Iraq War. Unfortunately, I was not someone who was offering advice about whether the Bush administration should invade Iraq. What I did do, and what I think you're referring to, during the Bush, President Bush appointed a council of scholars and scientists and philosophers and law professors to give public advice to him, but published papers on bioethical questions. And it began with the question of whether stem cell research, embryonic stem cell research, should be permitted and funded by the government. And it included other questions of bioethics and biotechnology. That was the council, the committee on which I served. And the view that I had, I was actually in the minority. I was among the dissenters. I was in favor of embryonic stem cell research and in favor of government support for it. We debated for 6 months about that question, and many of my colleagues on the council disagreed with me and thought that embryonic stem cell research was unethical because it destroyed the early embryo. And that was the debate that we had. And so I was in the minority. The Bush administration imposed restrictions on federal funding of embryonic stem cell research. I disagreed with that, and I expressed my view publicly. But it was a fascinating experience and a learning experience for me. I hadn't really understood much about the science of stem cell research until I had the opportunity to listen to the debates. We also discussed genetic engineering, which goes back to something that Professor Tong was asking about. Debates about whether genetic engineering for non-medical purposes is morally justified. And there I took the view that non-medical genetic manipulation is morally objectionable. So genetic engineering, genetic intervention to cure disease, I support. But genetic manipulation for enhancement, I see as a kind of consumer activity, getting back to the consumer preferences, that is connected really with the tradition of eugenics, which was mentioned by Professor Tong. So, for example, sex selection, choosing in advance the sex of your child, whether to have a boy or a girl, for no medical reason, but simply because you have a kind of consumer preference for a boy or a girl, I think is morally objectionable to use genetic engineering for that purpose. Or to make to give human growth hormone to a child who wants to be taller, a child of normal height but who wants to be taller to play in the basketball team. That's what I mean by non-medically necessary genetic enhancement. So I was a critic of genetic enhancement for non-medical purposes and a supporter of stem cell research, which seems to me morally important because it promotes curing of disease and disability. So those were the views that I expressed as a member of the President's Council on Bioethics during those years.